Thanks for listening to CarCast on Podcast One.
If you're interested in Tesla, don't miss Ride the Lightning, the Tesla unofficial podcast hosted every week by me, Ryan McCaffrey, a longtime Tesla owner and super fan. On episode 200, I had Elon Musk on for an hour. On episode 220, I talked to Tesla's chief designer, and I'm also there at every big Tesla event covering it in person. Ride the Lightning recaps and analyzes everything happening with the world's biggest EV automaker each week. Hear about the latest Cybertruck developments, the next-gen Roadster, the Model S Plaid, plus the newest updates to the Model 3, X, Y, and more. New episodes have been dropping every Sunday since 2015, so jump in and enjoy. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast service, or check it out at patreon.com/Tesla Podcast. That's Ride the Lightning, the Tesla unofficial podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to CarCast. We've got a great show this week. Every week is a great show, but this week we welcome IndyCar driver and all-around sports car racer Simon Pagenaud to the show. Before we get started, here's Geico. Would you love to save money on insurance? Well, of course, who doesn't love a good deal? Well, when it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even homeowners, condo, and renters coverage. Save even more with a special discount when you bundle coverages. Plus, add the easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24-hour roadside assistance, and the switch to Geico becomes a no-brainer. Switch today and see how you can save. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote or contact your local agent. Hello, welcome to CarCast. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, here alone today. Well, not alone, here with Chris. Goldberg is filming something today. I don't exactly know what he's filming. Filming something kind of came up, and I guess he had to, you know, he had to go off and do it. He's got to make money.
It is car related too.
It is so car related. Yeah, that's what we understand. It is car related. I did watch him on NCIS Los Angeles the other day. They get to put him in the Hellcat. So. He was excited. I'm sure that's the only thing he posted on social media was like, filming NCIS, got the Hellcat. So he's in all in on that. Let's see. We got Long Beach Grand Prix, or is it Grand Prix of Long Beach? I don't know. I always thought Long Beach Grand Prix, but I know it's the Grand Prix of Long Beach. It's coming up this weekend. So if anybody's going out to that, it's always a huge event. It's always a lot of fun. We're not going to be there the whole weekend. Chris is getting married.
Okay. I'm getting married on a Friday.
Chris is getting
What's going
married.
On a Friday?
You and he's not getting Saturday? Married in Long Beach where he lives.
You know, I know.
No, it'll
don't
be good.
You,
it's going to be fun.
You can stay at my house if you want.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you won't be there. The wedding's going to be fun. I'm excited about that. We're going to go out there Friday. We're going to come back Saturday. And then Adam and I will be going to Long Beach Grand Prix on Sunday. I just swung by yesterday, our friends at Anderson Composites. They're working on my Mustang Mach 1. We've got some carbon fiber stuff to debut. I think it's going to be pretty cool. I saw the hood, which we talked about. It has the hood scoop on it, you know, like a Mustang Mach 1 should have. It's not a separate hood scoop, like attached to the engine. We wanted to keep it very lightweight, so the scoop is integrated into the hood. So if you wanted to just swap out the hood and get a new one with the scoop, it has it. Now, I've always been sort of behind this, like, it has to be functional. And I know there's a lot of fake side scoops and hood scoops and stuff like that out there, especially on the OE cars, because of aerodynamics and too much air flowing through like the grill, and it suffers with miles per gallon and stuff like that. But in talking with Anderson, we wanted to make the scoop functional. So on top of the hood, there's the hood scoop, and then underneath the hood, there's a channel that is kind of flat and wide, and it directs air to the open element filter under the hood, and it's molded to fit that rubber gasket around the filter area. So it is a functional I don't want to say ram air as much as sort of a cold air, clean air. It doesn't change any of the stock induction system. So whatever air gets into the intake track through the air filter, that's all stock. But where the hood seals, you know, where the box seals around the hood, that now seals around basically a snorkel that attaches to the hood. So if you come out to Long Beach, come out and check it out. It should be pretty cool. It'd be cool to see the car there. And then we're going to actually be taking the car to a few other events and then ultimately to the SEMA show. And then we're going to be introducing some new parts along the way, stuff that we're getting made or stuff that's being developed between now and then. So this will have some of the carbon fiber parts on it. I think Fabulous Fords Forever, which comes up in a couple of weeks out here in California as well. I think the car will be there in the Anderson Composites booth again, and we'll have some more carbon fiber stuff on it and some new wheels and whatnot. So it's good. We've got some pretty exciting stuff in store for that. Let me tell you guys about Meguiar's, and then we're going to welcome our guest. We've got Simon Pagenaud, IndyCar driver, well, all-around race car driver, joining us. You know, car waxes have come a long way, and over the last few years, Meguiar's launched the next generation of protective products specifically geared toward DIYers. They have their hybrid ceramic spray wax, Meguiar's hybrid ceramic liquid wax, their hybrid ceramic spray detailer, and their hybrid ceramic wash and wax. And now they have the hybrid wash mitt as well. For 2022, Meguiar's has introduced the hybrid ceramic pre-wax prep. You can revive your paint easily, remove swirls and other minor defects. It's a really good product. And their hybrid ceramic trim restorer. This restores the darkness and shine to exterior trim. So now, Meguiar's, they have a full line of hybrid ceramic solutions for everyone. And for incredible water beating and protection and durability beyond traditional wax, it's ceramic made easy. It's Meguiar's. All right. There he is. There's the man. Simon, how are you?
Good morning, Matt. I'm going to need to get some of that Meguiar's stuff, man.
You should. Well, you got to put it, you've got to get it on.
It sounded good.
You got to get it on the motorhome and the whole rig. You got to get a team out there to do everything. Although this could make the car faster. This car could potentially make the race cars faster.
That's a very good sales pitch right there. Very good one.
I apologize. Goldberg wasn't able to make it. He had a last minute commercial shoot to do, but the plan was here, and they texted me and he's all upset about it. He's kind of pissed off about it. He's like, what the hell? And I was like, I don't know. This is when we have to do it. I'm excited to come out to Grand Prix of Long Beach, see you out there. It's been an exciting year. Some changes, certainly, right?
Lots of changes, yes.
Lots of changes. Well, aside from over just the past couple of years, I mean, coming off of an Indy 500 win to a marriage and a baby and a team change and racing with your buddy Elio. You know, it's sharing the team spotlight with that old man.
it's been a lot. There's definitely been a lot of changes, but you know, it's interesting. Sometimes changes is good. You know, sometimes it's good to put yourself in uncomfortable situations so you go find more within yourself. And quite frankly, you know, I had such a great time at Team Penske for 7 years, and we won pretty much everything that I wanted to win. And then I had this amazing offer from Mischenk Racing. It's more what their vision was about the future that really attracted me to the team. Obviously, teaming up with Elio was also another one. He's the king at the Speedway, you know. He's going for 5 this year, so hopefully I'm going for 2. But it's a really great environment that I really enjoy. It's a young team that we're trying to bring up to the top, and certainly we can start seeing the improvement and the march forward. So it's super exciting, added to the personal life changes, which honestly, it's like winning Indy every day.
Yeah, you know, we're not just talking, I mean, we're talking about Elio as a teammate, but on the IndyCar side, but with Meyer Shank Racing, you've got Oliver and Tom as well. And you guys had a lot of success at Rolex 24 this year. That's pretty exciting.
First race in, we win Daytona 24 hours. And I've been trying, you know, I've been trying for, I believe, 8 years to get that Rolex, get that win. You know, it's one of those classic in racing that you as a driver really want to have on the hunting board. You know, similar to Indianapolis, of course, similar to you would for a Formula One driver with Monaco. So personally, it was an achievement. It was something that, you know, when I retire in 20 years of time, that I'm glad I did it and I'm glad it's on the board.
I mean, you've been doing some sports car racing and other stuff for a long time, from, I don't know, maybe seven or eight years ago when you first came on to this show. You were racing everything you can get behind the wheel of, it seems like.
Yes, I did. It was a great time of my career. It was stressful because, quite honestly, I was still looking for, you know, that full-time ride in IndyCar. But I had full-time rides in sports cars. However, my goal was Indianapolis. My goal was to win the IndyCar championship also at a very young age. So, you know, when you have a dream and when you're a competitor, there's nothing that can really satisfy you until you get there and try. So it was a great time because I got to race Le Mans. I got to race Daytona. I got to race with amazing team like Team Peugeot in France. Being a French guy, that was huge to race for that team. The one of the highlights of my career was definitely doing Pikes Peak in a minivan with Honda.
Yeah.
That was special. And to this day, you know, it's one of the greatest memories.
You know, when you're talking about the sports car racing and IndyCar for that matter, I mean, the stage of the Indy 500 is so huge that, you know, adrenaline's pumping, the massive audience, got to be the biggest audience of any sport. It's just, you know, so it makes it such a big event, but it's a different type of event. So I was always kind of curious about, let's say if you took all of the fanfare out of racing and it was just you and guys on the track, are you more into the oval tracks or the road courses?
But it's interesting you say that because, you know, obviously I grew up in France not knowing anything about oval racing. My first oval race was 2012, Indianapolis. And since then, it's been a progression every year. We don't race that much on oval, quite frankly, as a IndyCar driver. When you see Jimmy Johnson's stats at Texas, where he did, I believe, 11,000 laps around that track in race mode, I think I did 2,000 in my career. So just shows you that we don't have as much experience on oval as a NASCAR driver. But I've learned to love it. There's a lot of things that the oval racing approach suit me really well because it's a very technical sport, technical skill to have, very tactical as well. And that's very much the way my brain works. So I enjoy it. I love the feel of it, you know, going through the corners at this kind of speed, sliding around. Playing with the draft, something I really enjoy in race mode. But, you know, my roots and my first love of racing was street course racing. So I would say it's pretty equal. I don't have a preference. At the moment, I just feel very, very confident going onto the oval.
Okay. You know, you're saying, you know, coming from France, oval racing wasn't really anything you had done. So when you first watch it on TV, you probably look at it and go, well, that looks easy enough. And then I get it when you go out there and it's much harder to do than you think. But, you know, now that you know, like you said, 2,000 laps already going around in circles, is it easier? Is it easier than the road course?
No, it's not easier. It's physically easier, yes. You don't get thrown around, you know, by the bumps, by the curbs, by braking, turning, accelerating. The G-forces on an oval are constant.
Okay.
So for some reason, it's not as tiring on the body. Although after Texas, I was really tired for a few days. It took me a while to recover. But it's a different kind of fitness. So I would say on the fitness side of things, road course, street course are tougher. Mentally speaking, I think the oval is tougher. So it's a different balance. I really enjoy it, but you know, when I did watch it back in the days when I wasn't racing oval, and still to this day, some friends are telling me the same thing. It looks easy from outside. What are you guys doing? It's a shame. Like, we've got to find a way to, you know, for people to feel it when they watch TV, to understand how tough it is to keep that car on the racetrack. And it's always going to be difficult because the movements are so small. But if it's erratic, then you're going to get off the racetrack. So it's a tough one.
Yeah. You know, I guess, yeah. So I wonder if you're how much does the strategy play into it? Like, we've seen so much oval racing, and there's such a big strategic game to it. And a lot of it is kind of won or lost on that. I mean, there's some great drivers out there, and, you know, obviously it's very competitive, and you got to make the right moves, and you got to be a little risky, but there isn't anybody really incompetent out there. Everyone's professional doing so. There's some strategy involved. So I just feel like, I don't know, like, well, first of all, when you run oval, do you have somebody talking in your ear the whole time more than you do when you're on the road course?
Oh yeah. Yes. I've got a good story for you on that one. So you have a spotter. In Indy, you have two spotter. One spotter covers one half of the track. The other spotter covers the other half because it's such a big track. So you have two different guys talking to you, different tone of voice. I mean, you have to get used to that doing 230 miles an hour. Decision process has to be really quick, but, there's that. Then there is, for me, it's Mike Shank. He's my strategist. And we prepare like a week ahead of the race. Usually we have documents flowing through and giving us ideas on what happened the previous years. The statistic of incidents on the racetrack, what lap it happens. So we kind of know the different scenarios. And it's something that we're working really hard on right now with Myoshank Racing, is trying to find a process on learning all these scenarios ahead of time. So then we can pick during the race what we need to do. Because at the end of the day, it's not really reading in a crystal ball strategy. It's, you know, it's about knowing what you have on the menu and choosing what you prefer. So it's very interesting. But in Texas, at the end of the race, the car was extremely loose. The rear end was sliding a lot. And my spotter was talking. Mike was talking on the radio. And I was like, guys, just please, just let me do my thing here. I've got to concentrate on driving. I'm going to crash otherwise. So, you know, it's you're always adjusting, but it's fun.
I imagine the scenario being a little like, I don't know, like a little like a parent. There's someone who's trying to be a good parent and say, you should do this and do this and do this, but, you know, do whatever you want. It's okay. Do whatever
exactly.
You want. Like, you should do this and this and this, but you decide. Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And it just gets kind of frustrating going, I don't know what to do. There's too many things going on. It's too many people talking to me at the same time.
It's a lot of information.
It's got a lot of information. And,
yeah.
And the spotters also can't really see each other. So like when we sit in a podcast studio, you know, with guests or co-hosts, you can kind of see when someone is going to talk. You can see their movement. You see them take a breath. And it gets crazy to listen on headphones when multiple people are talking over each other. In real life, it sounds natural, but in headphones, it sounds crazy. And I would imagine as being, you know, trying to handle 230 mile an hour around a track and have multiple people talk to you, and they can't really know what's going on with each other. They have to just sort of, you know, take a guess as to, you know, when one person stops talking and when they can get a visual on you, and then somebody else starts talking. So I can't imagine it's easy.
No, it's a tough one, I tell you. And that's one thing that on my radio we try to do is make sure that someone has priority on the channels, so then there's no overlap. It's another thing that's super important, because if there's an overlap of an very important information like pitting, you know, we need to pit to put fuel in the car, and I don't hear it, then it could be a disaster for the race. So we give priority to Mike, my strategist, just in case, you know, there's something I may miss.
All right. So let's back up a little bit. Let's, what was the family business? How did you get started? Because the family business wasn't originally racing, right?
No, family business is quite surprisingly, it's basically my grandfather, my great grandfather were in the grocery store business.
I was going to guess bakery.
Yeah,
I was going to guess bakery, but I was pretty close.
Close. It's pretty much how it started. Little groceries, little markets. And they started with a really small market with two people in it, and then they grew it. My grandfather ended up buying about seven at the time supermarkets, so grew a lot from the little markets. He bought seven, sold all that, and then started his own platform distribution for all the stores of the region, which was really smart. Then he sold and went to retirement really early. Sold one of the supermarket to my dad, and my dad took it from 50 people up to 250 employees now. So it's a huge supermarket, which, you know, my dad is incredible. He's my hero. What he's created is very impressive. So you could buy a dishwasher, you can rent a car, you can actually buy a cruise in the supermarket. He has everything. You can buy your sunglasses there or your flowers for your wife. So it's a one-stop shop. My dad was into racing, but not just passion from outside. We watched races when I was a kid. He taught me to drive at a young age on his lap, and that's where the fire started.
Yeah. What kind of racing were you guys into when you and your dad were watching?
It's really strange. There's no explanation for it. But at 4 years old, there was the battle between Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost in Formula One. Mm-hmm. They were fighting McLaren. And it was in the 1990s. So I was four, six years old. And I was watching Formula One every Sunday on TV. And my dad joined me. And then we started watching Formula One as a tradition every Sunday. And then we went go-karting at 10 years old when I was 10, started racing. Very low level, very low budget. But I think it helped me because I actually had to work on my go-kart myself.
And then it kind of grew from there. So you start off as a kid into racing, but at some point, you know, where the social development happens, right? You become a teenager. You got to go to high school. You meet girls. You learn to talk to people, and you start to think about what you want to do for a job. And did you have your sights set on something else? Like, was there a minute where like you wanted to be a farmer or a lawyer?
I always wanted to be a race car driver.
Well, but that's good. That makes it easy for a kid.
Easy, yes and no, because you know you. You know, I did a regular course of school, basically. I didn't go to, you know, specific training school for sports or anything like that. I did the regular way, which was tough because I was missing school quite a bit, especially when I was 16 years old, up to 18 years old, when I was doing Formula Renault in Europe. So I missed a lot of school, but my eyes were set from a very young age at being a race car driver, just wanting to be a race car driver. I didn't care what it was, just wanted to be a professional race car driver. And my dad was like, there's no way, you know, we're not in racing. Only the elite makes it. He says, I don't know how we could get there. I don't know how you could even think that's a possibility. So I just met people along the way basically helped, and there was talent. So it happens, but it wasn't meant to be. I studied to run a supermarket. I did 2 years of business school from 18 to 20. And like you said, it distracted me from racing. Girls, friends, going out. And I missed my shot for Formula One because of it. But, you know, it's part of life. I had to learn that part. And it taught me to be more disciplined later on in my career.
When did you get, let's say, the first paying gig as a racer? When did the tides turn and you knew you were going to do this for as ever, basically?
Yeah, forever, you never know.
Yeah, right?
Forever, it could stop tomorrow if you're not successful. that's the critical part with racing. And there are very talented kids right now that struggle to be professional, even though they have the talent and they should make it. But unfortunately, racing is very expensive. It's not like football. When you're a young kid, you have to rent your equipment into a race team. Usually the best costs more money. And if you do well, you go to the next level. You still have to pay to show what you can do. Then when you get to the top level, if you get there, then there are people hiring you to drive their race car. That's what happened to me when I came to the US in 2006 and won the Atlantic Championship. I had a big prize money to use to go to Champ Car. And that's how I became a professional. That's when I started making money. Touch wood, but it's never stopped since. But it was very tough at points. So 2007, I started making money, but April 2008, I was out of a ride, almost went back to France. Same thing happened in 2012, almost went back to France and do something else. So, it's never secure.
Yeah. Like you said, you take some prize money and you reinvest that into, the next move of your career. But yes, when you get hired as a driver on the team, I'm sure that's when you get to call home to dad and go, I got a job.
Yeah.
I got an actual job, dad. I'm going to get a paycheck in the mail. It's going to be fantastic. And at least I have a plan for whatever, for 12 months or something. We have a plan, and it does change a little bit, because for a small amount of time during those contracts, you get to think more about the job and a little less at getting the job, right?
You're right.
Over here, we've been putting together a beverage company this past year, and so much of Goldberg and I, and so much of it is, in this case, fundraising and getting the company, funded to get it off of the ground. And what does that look like? And what does that pitch look like? And you end up spending so much time on that, that when you do get your funding, it really does kind of change, because now you get to work, you get to do the job, you get to do the job you've been promising everybody you're going to do. And I like both aspects of it. I do enjoy, the obstacles and the challenges of doing the fundraising portion of it, but I do love running the business more and having to go back and do that. It's anybody who does freelance work as well, you're constantly trying to scratch up work, and then you do the actual work. But then when you do the actual work, you realize, but also now you're the accounts receivable person. You got to handle the money. You got to go after the money. If they don't pay you, you got to chase it down. You gotta do all this other stuff that it doesn't leave much time for the actual work. So when you do get a nice gig, or you get a contract, as you say, or you get some sort of promise to race a car for a certain amount of time, you get to, listen, when you get that type of gig, you end up, the 2016 IndyCar champion. You end up as an Indy 500 winner, right? You get to
it helps because you can prepare better, right? You can hire a personal coach for the mental side of things, the physical side of things. Where I've lost a lot of time in my young career, basically not having my family in racing, I didn't know how to prepare to do the job, like you're saying. So if you look at a Max Verstappen, for example, at 18, he was ready to win Grand Prix. It to me, it's incredible. But he was, trained by his dad, who was a Formula One driver. And his dad, I believe, is an incredible coach, obviously, with a kid that has a lot of talent. But personally, I had to go through the growth of a teenager, definitely. I had to learn the job. And even today, I'm still looking at how could I be better? What do I need to do? Is it, do I need to tweak my nutrition here? Do I need to do something on hydration? Is there stuff I can do with my brain to work better in the race car? And all this stuff I'm learning every day, management, within the team, like how do I extract the best out of everybody? It's incredible, but I'm still learning today. And if I had known what I know 5 years ago, which is a very famous sentence to say,
yeah,
then I would have been so much better, right? But it is part of anyone's course, and it's quite interesting. But certainly, when you have that contract in hand, you can invest it the right. If you invest it the right way, it's very helpful. Although in racing, you do need to be a bit on the hot seat to perform at your top level, because it's you have to have such a high commitment that you can't be comfortable.
You know, and there's also there's a different scenario between, you know, team owners or owner racers versus hired guns, if you will. And the hired gun in all forms of racing, drag racing, sports car racing, you know, IndyCar racing, you know, it is a different type of thing for sure. Even if you don't listen, I'm not saying it's easier to have family legacy in racing. I'm just saying it's a different path to have family legacy in racing. You know, you compete, you know, every week basically with another good friend of ours, Graham Rahal, but Graham's path was a little different, right? Graham's path with Bobby Rahal, you know, as a team owner or just as a dad who's been down that path is different than yours. Your path with dad, the superstore grocery owner,
yeah, you
know, which I'm sure he calls. He's like, listen, there's always a fallback plan. I've got a really nice store over here. You can still run if you want to.
That's what my dad would say. You're right.
You know, so don't.
That's what he would say.
You know, he's like, hey, listen, maybe it's just the second chapter. If you ever want it, it's here. It's available. We got this awesome store for you. You know, so you know, and talking with guys like Graham. You know, wants to do with you what you're doing. Graham wants to envision racing for the next 10 years. But, you know, a guy like Graham is also thinking about, you know, the family business and car dealers and Graham Rahal Performance and a Ducati dealer and just other things that he's going on that he's interested in. It's not the same for everybody. But I think that path of racing legacy is a different path. And I respect and admire both paths, but for things that I've done in my life, there wasn't a legacy behind the choices that I've made. As a matter of fact, a lot of them were the opposite. I would pick different choices and see where it would go. I don't know how I ended up sitting in a studio doing podcasting, but eventually that path led me here, you know, for whatever, almost 13 years now. So it was a little bit different path. Going back, you were saying that there was an opportunity for F1 that was sort of a lost opportunity, right? Why is that? Is it does F1 feel like there's like an age cutoff? Like if you don't make something within a certain age, you're kind of done? Is there an opportunity for, I don't know, for a 30-year-old to get into F1.
So I got to go back a little bit to explain. So let me remind you, my first real season at a high level, I'm just saying high level because up until 16 years old, I was doing go-kart on the weekend, on the Sunday. We would just pack up the go-kart and go and race. Didn't matter if it was a national, French champ, national French race or regional. But I did mostly regional, which was a very low level. We had the same set of tires for the entire season, the same engine for 7 years. it was pretty bad. My dad didn't want to spend money on this. So, you know, I was already very fortunate to have a go-kart and go racing. But then at 16 years old, some people saw me drive and pushed my dad to get me into this driving school called the Volant Elf in France, in Le Mans, and I won. So then my first year at 16 years old, I was kind of for the first time at national level. So that's the first year at 16. At 17, Renault saw me perform on the racetrack and got interested. So they started sponsoring my career, and then they offered a contract at 18 years old with Renault Formula One. There was a pool of drivers that were picked up by Flavio Briatore, two, like Fernando Alonso, for example, was the top one of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Roberto Kubica was in it as well. And they had a pool of driver, and the ones that were going to stand out were going to go to Formula One. The thing is, the standing out process was quite tricky. There wasn't any training or help, except for the money, which was very important. But that it didn't help me to learn the job. So at 18, they said, okay, just go do what you do. We're sponsoring you. If you do well, you go to Formula One. Okay, no pressure here at 18 years old, 17.
Yeah.
But I'm not ready for the job, and you're putting a lot of pressure on me. So, you know, first race, you go in, you got talent, you put on the pole, and you crash in the first corner, and so on and so forth. And I didn't know how to balance that out. And that's when I discovered meditation. But that was too late. They already had cut me off. So I missed my chance there. If I had been ready a year earlier and not distracted by, you know, the things of a teenager and be focused on the job, then I might have had a shot at least at trying a Formula One car and show what I could do. But I missed it. I missed it because of that reason. And it's such a small world, Formula One, that if you miss your chance once, you're done. And that was it for me. You know, I was 18, middle of so many other good drivers of my generation. And then I had to make a choice: go to the US and try IndyCar.
It's a lot to ask for a 16, 17, 18 year old. You know,
it was. I mean, it really was.
I mean, yeah. you're asking a kid to basically decide the rest of their life, right? Because nobody says, hey, I'm going to be a Formula One race car driver for 3.5 years, and then I'm going to be a film director, and then I'm going to be a baseball player, right? Like nobody gets to really make those types of decisions because, you know, anybody that backs you wants you 100%. So it's a really big decision to make, you know, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old. I mean, you think of how many people even just go to college, like what you were even talking about. You know, listen, a lot of people have their sights set on a career, and college is a backup plan. Like, I'm going to educate myself on a different career just in case. But there's a lot of people that go to college with a plan to make that their career, and that's not what their career is going to be, right? So,
absolutely.
And that happens, I think, quite a bit. When you're 18, this opportunity isn't there. But do you take a break? Do you slow down? Obviously, you're a little down on yourself, going, well, this, you know, what do I do now? Because it kind of felt like it was the only thing.
Yeah.
How much time between that?
Sorry.
How much time between that before you get back in the saddle and start racing?
It really was a wake up call. But again, it was only my second year. I was only my second year racing a high level, which is, you know, all those kids I was around, they were racing world championship in go-kart since they were 12 years old. So I was behind already. But so what happened is it was a big wake-up call, because I realized, okay, it's talent's important. Obviously, you know, a guy like Fernando made it on talent because his talent was just monstrous. My set of skills was a bit different, but I hadn't peel the layers yet of what it was. I was still a raw diamond without pretension, but I needed to shape it. And but the problem is how do we keep going racing? Now, my dad took it. It was interesting because my dad was not in favor of me racing, but because of the adversity and seeing how I reacted to it, he got more interested in me and how we could succeed to get me what I wanted. So what he did is, we were kind of in a corner. Racing was very expensive. At 19, we were looking at going do the Formula Renault European Championship. And didn't go well with my previous team, so we had to change team. But I knew that I had to be in a top team, so it was going to cost a lot of money. So he said to me, he said, listen, the only way we're going to go racing is for you to find money. I said, oh, what? Great. What do you want me to do? How do I find, you know, this was at the time 240,000 euros a season, which today is nothing compared to what it was. And I said, okay, I don't know how to do that. He says, I'm going to help you. I'm like, thank you. He says, no, we're going to build a business and you're going to make profit and you're going to put the profit on racing. I said, what kind of business? He says, what? Don't you like going to the racetrack? I said, yeah. He says, why don't you start your own driving school? And I'm like, okay, why not? So then he said, okay, you can use my network. You can use your network because you have one already of business owners. You go see them. You do it on your own. And you you have to find a way so it's a win-win situation when you do your sales pitch. Okay. So we build a company, basically. That was a driving school company. We rented cars from a racetrack. And we rented the track on days, and I managed to go see business owners and booked full days at the racetrack. I learned how to run the business. So for my dad, it was smart because he could see that I was shaping myself into a business owner.
Yes.
But also I was gathering the money to go and race. So it was a win-win for him as well.
I know your dad's a great mad scientist. I love this strategy.
It was.
Of him teaching you what he knew. He may not have known racing that much, but he knew how to build a business, and he wanted to show you how to build that business. So even if the racing thing didn't work out, and I'm glad to see it did,
he was
like, but you know what you can do. You know what you can do now.
Yeah, and it turned out to be a really successful business. I mean, if racing didn't work, I could have done that my whole life and have a really successful business. So, you know, it's still something that, you know, I may go back to when I'm older because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing the smiles of people when they step out of the race car. And I enjoyed taking them on ride-alongs with me. It's something that I really loved. And to this day, I still do it. When I go back to France, I invite some of my best previous partners and we do a day together. So it's fun. But that's how basically I disciplined myself. I had to wake up every day at 5 a.m., go on the road, meet my sponsors. I had to do as many meetings a day to gather money.
Yeah.
So it was efficient. But then I had to race. And that's when it became difficult also to manage the balance of being an athlete and also being a businessman at the same time. But it worked. I finished second in the European Championship and my career took off again.
Yeah, that's a fantastic story. What's the plan now? This is year one with Meyer Shank Racing. I'm sure there's a lot of discussions about where to go from here. And listen, Elio, to his credit, you know, his Indy 500 win cast a bright light on, for lack of a better term, anti-ageism. You know, everyone's jokes about him being kind of the old man, but turns out the old man can haul ass. So, and by the way, just a likable dude. He's just such a good, likable guy, and he's been here before. I think he's been in the studio with us before as well. So, what is 5 years, 10 years look like for you?
It's interesting you ask, because to me, my whole career, I've always looked 5 years ahead. And I think, you know, that's the key to success in racing. You can't just look at 1 year, take the money, then whatever. No, because you have to be successful. It's taking the money is not the essence of being a race car driver. You have to drive for the passion of driving and for seeking success. What is success? To me, success is being the best lap I can do and feeling like I was one with the race car. If I do that, I know I'll win races. So, you know, results can come next. But this next chapter is exactly where I wanted to be at this time. You know, my career is, I've had 10 years, 11 years of racing in IndyCar racing, hopefully another 10. But my goal is definitely with Meyer Shank Racing is to help them grow into a top team. There's a lot we can do. It's a young team that has a lot of potential, great talent in it. And I want to be involved. I want to be involved in the management, in the performance side of things. And I want to give all the experience I've gathered throughout the years and try and help Bikeshark Racing go to the top. And that's their vision of where we're going to be in 5 years that I was really interested in. The way that Mike Shank manages the team is a very modern way of doing things. He's very open, always there with his mechanics. I really enjoy that. And Jim Meyer, an incredible businessman. So, you know, we've got all the tools to do well. And it's just a matter of working on all the little details and building the castle. So it's a lot of fun. And that's where I see myself for the next few years. And hopefully we can be at the top as soon as possible.
Is there a race or any particular type of racing that you want to go back and do again, or something you haven't tried yet, like rally racing? Or you mentioned Pikes Peak was a fun experience. I know you've been to Le Mans a couple times. A win at Le Mans wouldn't be bad.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is there's a potential for my Shank racing to go to Le Mans someday. So, you know, that would be amazing to be part of that trip. If they don't go, I want to go back to Le Mans and try to, you know, I finished second there, so I would want to try and and contend for the win. That is a dream. And definitely, you know, looking 10 years ahead, it would be amazing to say that I won Le Mans as well as the other races. So that is a goal of mine. Far-fetched dream is something that I'm definitely going to do is I want to do rally. I really, you know, originally, actually, my real passion for racing is rally, the World Rally Championship. And, you know, I would have dreamt to win the Monte Carlo rally. So, I'll try. I don't know if I can be able to win someday, but I will try it. And at least I'll have the fun of driving those cars like it is. And I just love it.
We've been noticing more and more of that because the rally cars, the vintage rally cars are starting to just go up in value and they're just getting so much attention. But, you know, the Le Mans cars as well. Listen, Meyer Shank Racing, you got a 4-man team that just won Daytona. That'd be a pretty good team at Le Mans. Just saying. Seems like a pretty good team to bring to Le Mans. They've got, while everyone is still hyped up on off coming off of that Daytona. The other thing I wanted to mention real quick before we wrap up is, you know, you're talking about Meyer Shank Racing, a great team, great people, partnered with SiriusXM and AutoNation and the Drive Pink program. You guys got all the pink cars out there. Pink everywhere, which looks good. But this is, you know, this is also fundraising for cancer research. I think this program that you guys have has raised about $30 million so far. So, you know, the cars look good. Not that the Menards car wasn't that bad looking, but that thing is bright.
I know. It was really bright.
That was a very, very bright car. Interesting to see on the track. Probably not the most fun to wear the suit all the time. But this is a great program that you guys have with Drive Pink.
Yeah, it's an amazing program. You know, it's great to be able to give back. Obviously, we have amazing partners like AutoNation, SiriusXM, and Arctic Wolf just came on board this year. But definitely, this program is to fight for cancer is really great. And there's so many connections with AutoNation and our team. You know, even Firestone, they even brought us tires when we rolled the car into pit lane. We have pink tires. we're the only ones to have that. I think it's great. You know.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to see you. We're going to see you this weekend. Do you know what the schedule is for Sunday? What time do you guys go out? There's an opening.
I have the schedule. I just looked it up because, you know, schedules have changed. It's a bit different than it was the past years, and it's difficult to find times to do everything. So we have a warm up around 9 o'clock in the morning, Sunday, and then the race is around 12 noon.
Okay.
So really fast morning. And it's supposed to be really nice in the 70s, so it's going to be a great day.
It sounds fantastic. We're going to be out there. As I mentioned, Adam Kroll and I are going out there. He's somewhere like 9 or like probably right after your warm-up, after 9, maybe around 9:30 or 10. Adam's going to do some laps in the Acura NSX. He's gonna give some sponsors and VIPs and stuff. Yeah, he's going to.
Cool.
Now, he's been out there a few times with the previously with the Toyota Pro Celebrity Race. He won as a celebrity and came back and won as a pro, which he continues to remind us a lot. And he is going to be going out there for driving the NSX. I think he's going to have a lot of fun doing that car because I've driven that car and I like it. I don't know that he's driven that car, but the NSX is fast. But the NSX is what's cool about being able to take it on the track like that is although the NSX is a cool car, it's very easy to drive and it just feels like an Acura on the street until you really put it in the track mode and then it becomes a really impressive, a race car, if you will. And I think hopefully they'll get it set up in track mode for him so he can go out there and, you know, give some fun
it's a
rides.
Beast.
Yeah,
he's gonna do like
a 30-minute session out there, and
that's
then,
cool.
You know, and
that's
then.
Awesome.
And then we'll see how he does. If he does well, maybe we'll get him to join your Le Mans team.
Why not? We always need a reserve driver, you know?
That's good. Yeah, we'll all get a trip to France. And then we'll meet your dad. We'll shop at his store, at his superstore.
That's the goal. I'd take everybody to the store.
That's I would too. I would just take
Buy
everybody to the store.
Want.
Yeah, I want sunglasses and a rental car. Simon, I appreciate it you coming on the show. I know the schedule is busy, and looking forward to seeing you on Sunday. Hopefully after your warm-up session I'll have an opportunity to swing by, and again I know it's a busy day for you, but I'll stop by over there and say hello and wish
Please
you luck
do.
And I'm looking forward to your win.
Please do. Thank you. I cross fingers, you know, it's possible. You know, three races in, it's evolved really nicely. So it's very possible. We'll see what happens. At the end of the day, it's about execution. So we'll see what we can do.
Thanks, buddy. I'll see you there. Good luck.
Thanks, Matt.
All right. So that's fantastic. I'm very excited to have Simon back on the show. And it's a crazy schedule over there and all the press and stuff that they have to do. But, you know, it's always good to connect with Simon. All right, so I think we're running out of time here. Are we missing anything, Chris?
I think we got it.
All right, then until next week, keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
Would you love to save money on insurance? Of course, who doesn't love a good deal? Well, when it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, GEICO can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even homeowners, condo, and renters coverage. Save even more with a special discount when you bundle coverages. Plus, add the easy-to-use GEICO mobile app and 24-hour roadside assistance, and the switch to GEICO becomes a no-brainer. Switch today and see how you can save. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote or contact your local agent.